right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5. Glad to have you along. It's time to check in with Quinn Hillier, the man behind, oddly enough, QuinnHillier.com. Also the author of the Mad Jones trilogy, available on Amazon. And check out his work in the Washington Examiner. And I guess that's what they did at the New York Times, as we talked yesterday more about that Time story about Tommy Tuberville and the hedge fund. Quinn joins us now. Thanks for your time.
Thanks. Good morning.
Morning. And yeah, let's talk about, a lot to talk about here. The Tuberville story here, this is one that, this Quinn, a lot of this information has been bounced around for a couple months, right? And then you kind of drug out some more on this, and now over the weekend, the Times did as well. Explain what's alleged here against Tommy Tuberville.
Okay, well, first of all, just to say, even though it might have been bouncing around sort of people talking about it, nobody actually put it down until I did about
three weeks ago.
Tuberville had this hedge fund, two-person hedge fund with his good buddy John David Stroud, only two people, and he actually put out paperwork for the people that signed up for the hedge fund, gave them control of their money. He put out paperwork that said he would personally be directing the investments, each and every investment. And then it turned out that there was massive fraud, and his partner went to federal prison, got a 10-year sentence. I don't think he served the whole 10 years, but went to federal prison, and Tuberville basically got off of the criminal charges by saying, well, I'm literally, direct quote, I'm not smart enough to understand the numbers. And he said he lost money too, and it was all his buddy's fault, and the buddy copped a plea and said, yeah, it's all my fault. And so Tuberville just made some sort of sealed settlement, out of court settlement. And the problem is, you can't tell the investors that you are directly supervising every single investment, and then tell the court that, well, no, my buddy directed the investments, I'm just the front man. Now, the latter story might actually be true. It looks like he probably was just the front man, but that at the very least makes him dishonest for selling the investors on the idea that he was going to be hands-on. You can't have it both ways. You can't say, I'm hands-on, and then say, I'm too dumb to understand the numbers.
Okay.
So I did that story. The New York Times finally came in, followed up, added some more to it, showed even more ways that he had actually traveled to meet with people on, I think it was Wall Street, but traveled to New York, stuff like that. And so he was at least semi-active. And the thing that they did, that I knew they would, is they went to the investors and said, will you talk to us? And the investors said no, so they asked Tuberville's people, will you give them permission to talk to us? And Tuberville said no.
So do you think they're bound? That's why they're bound by NDAs?
Well, I mean, that's what usually happens when there's an out-of-court settlement. A sealed out-of-court settlement, you don't discuss it unless you're released from the non-disclosure or whatever you want to call it. I don't know if it's technically an NDA or whatever, because we don't know what the terms were. But if Tuberville had nothing to hide, his lawyers would gladly tell the investors, okay, you can talk to the New York Times, you can talk to the Washington Examiner, you can talk to Sean Sullivan. But instead, they said, no, you can't.
Quinn, I know back when this happened, quite a few outlets were reporting on this, but Tuberville has been running now for the Senate seat for nearly a year. Why is this just coming out since you posted this 3 weeks ago? Why didn't any other candidates try to use this going into the primary?
I don't know. I mean, I'm pretty sure that others had it. Maybe they were saving it for the runoff. Maybe they didn't want to get tarred with negative advertising. I don't know. But when I got it, I started looking into it, realized that I didn't have the resources to go and knock on every door.
We lose Quinn.
Hold up.
There you go.
Court documents. And, you know, and so I said, somebody's going to do a big story on this later. We might as well get it out there now.
And that's right. That's the side discussion to this is, well, if this is happening now, what wait till Doug Jones's people get hold of this? They've got more on this. This is what they're going to bring to fight Tuberville in the general. And I don't know. I mean, do you see this as something that could change the balance for Doug Jones?
Well, it could, depending on what they have. The key thing is the New York Times paragraph that said none of the investors would talk to us now, and Tuberville's people would not let us if it was okay to talk to them. That's what the other shoe to drop is. You know that once they get to the runoff, suddenly somebody's going to want to talk. And if there's anything more damning than we know, then that somebody talking, that's the other shoe to drop. That's the thing that nobody knows, because this is a guy who has never been politically vetted before. I mean, that's what the New York Times, Washington Post do. They did it to Roy Moore. They did it to, I mean, I can run down the list of Republican candidates. They go after the Republican candidates after they get the nomination, so the party is stuck with them. They might put a little teaser out there beforehand, and then they come with the big guns after.
Well, with the Roy Moore story, that might be a different situation. But I would say, for the most part, the people that are voting in this Republican primary don't have high favorability ratings for the New York Times or the Washington Post. I'm just, we know how news organizations work, and it doesn't seem like there's much sex or murder or mystery involved in this story. Do you think that this will connect with the common voter?
Well, again, if this is what's out there now, it's probably just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, as I say,
can you fairly say that? I mean, can you say just because this is here, there must be much more?
I've identified the paragraph that says there is probably more, and that is that the people aren't talking. When they talk, what will they say? That's the key question. If you have a two-person hedge fund, only two people run it, and you say you're directing each and every investment, and one guy goes to jail, how does the other guy skate?
Well, I mean, we talk about this quite a bit, right? That you could say, like you said, the testimony was, well, he didn't know all the details. You could say he misrepresented himself when the hedge fund was put together. They brought in the investors, but he truly was not at fault here with what happened.
Yeah, so which makes him not criminal, but merely dishonest. But the question then becomes, if, quote, I'm not smart enough to understand the numbers, then how should he be overseeing the $3 trillion federal budget?
Has Tuberville commented on this, or do you think he'll just kind of let this pass, hope that this story just passes?
No, he told the New York Times no comment, or his people did.
Do you think, out of the other case that's been discussed, that Clifton Robinson case, to me that one has more chance of damage, I think, than this one for folks. I mean, I talked to enough people that seem to just not care about this case. Not saying they shouldn't, but they don't care. But the Clifton Robinson case may get more attention because you have that element of, you have a player that was sexual violation of a girl, and then that player, Clifton Robinson, doesn't get any more suspension than people that stayed out after curfew. That one may have more legs.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, if he's a fourth stringer, he probably gets a lot more than a one-game suspension. The problem is not that we know. I mean, it was a statutory rape charge. It could have been consensual, but it was an 18-year-old and a 15-year-old. That's an 18-year-old and a 15-year-old. That's getting very iffy. That's pretty dicey stuff sometimes. And for Tuberville to have somebody convicted of that and to say, okay, you only miss one game, that shows a very bad lack of judgment and lack of taking it seriously. I'm not saying the guy should have been forever, you know, have his life ruined if it was some kind of consensual thing, but one game, as you said, that's the same punishment he gave for people that missed curfew. You got to have some kind of scale of importance, and clearly Tuberville didn't think that it was important, and most of us would say, you know what, statutory rape, that's pretty important.
All right. When we come back, as people get ready for your opinion on President Trump's speech at Mount Rushmore, let me just go ahead and give them a tease. In your headline here, you said the speech was monumentally splendid.
Monumentally. Yes,
indeed. Okay, coming right back. We'll talk more about this monumentally splendid speech of President Trump over the weekend. We'll do that with Quinn Hillier when we return. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5. Sean Dalton continuing our discussion with Quinn Hillier. And Quinn, this is good. I want to start off with the first paragraph here of your story at the Washington Examiner. You said, despite so much media drivel about President Trump giving a dystopian or dark and divisive or out-and-out racist speech at Mount Rushmore, his Friday speech as written was the single finest of Trump's presidency. You're going to get me to go back and watch this because I was not around. I did not watch it. And to be frank with you, you're right. I've seen all the hot takes on it, that it was anything but a good speech. And you're saying au contraire.
Well, I didn't watch it either. I didn't listen. Trump's delivery turns me off. So I wanted to get away from the personal impression and look at just the words of the speech, which you can call up on the White House website. And, you know, if you take away his tone of voice and his mannerisms, which some people like and others don't, I figured the neutral way is to look at the words on the page. And when I read that speech, I was expecting, oh my goodness, here comes, you know, this terrible thing that all the reporters were writing about. Straight news reporters calling it flat out racist, as if that's a straight news way to report something. And I read the thing, I'm like, this is magnificent. They were upset because he spent the first fifth of the speech and then another paragraph or two way down in the speech. So about a quarter of the speech total, he was saying, we are faced with a radical leftist movement that wants to destroy our heritage, tear down statues of our founders, and won't allow anybody to dissent with them, and they crack down if you dare utter a thought that disagrees with them. And he said, this is not what America is. And then he spent the last three quarters of the speech saying what a great place America is, giving examples, setting aspirations for ways to do it even better, to make this country even, you know, to build on its strengths. Yeah, I mean, it really was a good speech, and everybody's upset. All the liberal media is upset because he dared spend the first bit of the speech and another paragraph later talking about the fact that the leftist mob wants to shut you up. Well, you know what? That's not him being dark and divisive. That is him responding to an attack that other people being dark and divisive against the entire tradition of the country of free speech and of free expression of pride in their country. And Trump was just describing it as it is. I mean, there's the UCLA professor. There's a movement to fire a UCLA professor because he said the N-word in class. You know when he said the N-word in class?
No.
He was quoting Dr. Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail. He was quoting the original source document, and you know, King, Martin Luther King, in his piece said, this is what we face. We have people calling us inward something, and other people, you know, other times were treated as inward this. He quotes King from a source document, and they want to fire him for quoting Martin Luther King. That's insane. And that stuff is going on all over the country, and Trump was pointing it out and saying, we're better people than this.
Mm-hmm. Quinn,
he's right. We are better people than this.
I didn't see the speech in its entirety, but I watched quite a few clips. And, I mean, talk about the setting, and with it being Independence Day, and he's in front of Mount Rushmore. The Blue Angels flew over Mount Rushmore. I mean, it was as American as it gets. And like you mentioned, the media just they called it divisive and a hateful speech. I'm just, you know, if you look at what the president said, even if you just read the transcript, like you said, is being patriotic now racist? Is that where
we
are now?
Yeah, it is. And 4 years ago, CNN. Four years ago, NPR called, made reference to Mount Rushmore as, you know, some event was there, and it said in front of them the carvings of four of the great presidents in history. Today, or this week, NPR, supposedly straight news report, said words like Trump dared speak in front of Mount Rushmore, which features two presidents who own slaves, mm-hmm. and another who you know, something like jingoistically you know, did colonialism or something like that, referring to Teddy Roosevelt. So the same thing that 4 years ago under Obama was patriotic is now racist. And that's a straight news report, supposedly. They didn't even label that opinion.
Well, it's just, we were talking last hour about Target pulling the Washington Redskins merchandise. You know, I would point out that, so 2 months ago, it was okay. It was okay, Target, to sell the Washington Redskins merchandise, but now it's okay, not okay. In 2 months, it's changed.
Every single poll that has been done, I think I'm right on this. I shouldn't say every single, but I think I read every single poll. You know, 3 months ago or 6 months ago, every poll on this of Native Americans say that a majority of Native Americans wants Washington to keep the name Redskins. A majority of Native Americans themselves, because what it has the implication of fierce warriors, strong, you know.
Right.
Noble, and they see it that way. Now, yeah, there's a very noisy minority of Native Americans that take offense at it, and it's a shame. But it's also, you know, the history of it was not to make fun of Indians, that's for sure.
Right, Quinn, before you run out of time, I want you to remind folks, if they have yet to pick up the Matt Jones trilogy, how do they do that?
They do that at Amazon.com, and I've got to say, there is a racist cop in there who uses the N-word, and he gets his comeuppance for doing so, but it's literature, he uses the N-word, so be careful.
So it's in there before, so, you know, there's a chance that book could be banned.
Yeah, there's a chance that book could be banned, a book that shows that being racist is bad. It treats him as a redeemable but bad character. And the way that it does it is it shows racists use the N-word. So he uses the N-word, so now they're going to ban the book, just like they want to ban Huck Finn, which is, of course, you know, not at all racist.
Quinn Hillier, we appreciate your time. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks.
All right, coming right back. All right, let's bring on to the air former senator of the state of Alabama and candidate in the Republican primary for Senate once again. Jeff Sessions joins us now. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Sean. Good to be with you. 1 week out.
It is 1 week out. Yeah, it is. It's and people need to remember, I know it seems strange, but we're voting in July. Remember that, y'all. We're voting in July.
That is right. July 14th.
Let's talk about a couple things. I was looking at your event in Montgomery the other day, and when you were at that, you were talking about your opponent here, Tommy Tuberville, being weak. That's what he was saying about you, and you're turning around and saying that it's he who's weak.
Look, I've been strong. I think the people of Alabama know that. There's one thing people criticized me for, and that's recusal, and I had to follow the law on that. But I stood up for Alabama values. I fought for them. I led the fight against almost impossible odds and blocked the bogus amnesty bill that they tried to pass. I led the fight against Obama trade and many other issues, the budget issues. I was the number one voice in the Senate. I was the first to endorse Donald Trump. Was that weakness? I'm going to tell you what's weak: avoiding debates, refusing to talk about issues, hiding from the press. I've been on every radio and question program in the state, all over this state. Tommy Tuberville is hiding out. He's not ready for this job. He's afraid to answer questions about the fraud scheme he was involved with. He's afraid to answer the questions about the football player who got one game suspension for having a sexual relationship with a 15-year-old who visited campus. And other issues he's talked about, like China, he doesn't agree with President Trump's China policy. So those are things that if you're going to be a United States senator, you can't hide out. I mean, let me tell you who's in the Senate: Chuck Schumer, Dick Durbin, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris. Are you going to be able to defend yourself against them and our values and stand up to them like I have done throughout my career? I'm not weak. He's weak. He's not ready to be our senator. Doesn't even seem to be particularly interested in it, actually. The issues that that we have to be engaged with day after day.
Now, I want to talk about the two stories you just mentioned. We talked about them earlier this hour as well. First of all, the Clifton Robinson case. This says to you what? I mean, because he gave a suspension to the player, but just a one-day suspension, right? Or one-game suspension.
Yeah, I think that, he rolls out some staffer to make some excuse. And what is the excuse? Well, doctors tell me when a player is physically ready to play, and I listen to them. The police tell me when a football player is ready to go back in the game. I've never heard of coaches say that. Coaches have standards. They set standards for their players. They have to send a message about what's acceptable. Having sex with a 15-year-old girl visiting her sister on campus is not a little matter. He was suspended, this player was, for one game by Terry Bowden for curfew violation. So he gets one game for this. And what lesson does that say to the other players, the young men? He needs to be setting a good, clear example about what's acceptable behavior. So I think he should personally answer that. He's avoiding that. Secondly, on this fraud case, likewise, he rolls out one of his aides who mumbles through an interview yesterday that was pretty pathetic, if you want to know the truth. He's avoiding responsibility. Sean, you know, I was the United States Attorney in Mobile for 12 years, and we prosecuted lots of fraud schemes. This one has a lot of those patterns. They promise that we're going to pay you. These fraudsters never take responsibility. So he says, it's not my fault. I'm a victim. And he promised during to keep the scheme afloat that they would be paid. But they had to sue him. And only on the courthouse steps after the judge denied all the motions and he had to go to trial that he paid some money to those victims. And it does not appear they've been fully made whole. He needs to answer that. We're talking about sending this man to the Senate. He forms a hedge fund, Sean, just two of them, Tuberville and Stroud. The name of it was T&S Capital. Tuberville said, carried a card around that said he was the managing partner. He says he would be involved in the paperwork that involved in all investment decisions. two things I would say about that. One is, Tommy Tuttle, these hedge fund guys, most of them are got PhDs in physics from MIT. Tommy Tuberville thinks he's going to form a hedge fund and get average people, Alabamians, to give him money so he can invest them. He majored in PE. I mean, what does he know about running a hedge fund, first and foremost? What does he know about the United States Senate? He brags about not knowing anything about the United States Senate. He's not ready for this job, and I don't think he should be elected to the Senate. Given the Republican nomination, unless he's willing to stand before the voters and explain how it was that his partner went to jail for 3 years out of Opelika, and he was sued for fraud and apparently had to pay $1 million or more out of the $7 million he extracted from Auburn a year or so before.
Now, I want to talk about a little more on that case as well, as the NDAs, right? I mean, you've got these people that were clients of this TS Capital. I'm guessing they have NDAs because they're not speaking.
Right, on non-disclosure agreement. Oh, that was a monumental non-disclosure agreement. That was very, very important to them. So they've written out this agreement to try to keep anybody from discussing what happened. But a lot of it just plain public record. I mean, he said he was the managing partner, and he vouched for this Stroud, and it went bad quickly. And they didn't shut it down. He didn't call on an accountant to come in and clean up the mess. He started promising people they'd be paid. He did not handle that in a high level, in my opinion, and he needs to answer it. Look, this is classic fraud. You get people to invest in an organization, you spend the money on your personal well-being, and you don't make the investments you promised to make. So, you know, he did get his insurance paid out of that. He drove around in a leased BMW that apparently the fund paid for. Why did he do it? It was really really greed. He thought he could make more millions. He'd just been paid seven. He had a $5 million payout from Auburn in the contract clause if he were terminated, fired. But somehow he extracted another $2 million from them. That was a long time ago. A $7 million payout is huge. And so I guess he wanted more money. He's going to create a hedge fund and use his name. He complains they used my name. He knew what he was in the deal for. His name. And he was vouching for this fund and encouraging people to trust me, invest in it. It was not a good thing. He needs to explain that.
All right, we're coming right back. More with Jeff Sessions right here on FM Talk 106.5. Continuing on with our discussion with former senator and candidate for Senate in the Republican primary runoff that happens a week from today, Jeff Sessions. And I guess a couple questions here. Number one, just your message to your supporters. I know it's turnout, but do you also have the absentee ballots being a big factor, I'm sure, in this election, right? We have till July 9th on that, and I think there are people that will participate in absentee that have never in the past.
Yeah, you can vote absentee. You can ask for your ballot until July 9th, and then you can go to the clerk's office and actually vote. Just go down there, walk in there, and fill out and vote, and then leave, and you've cast your ballot. We are urging people to turn out. It's so important that our friends in Mobile and South Alabama turn out for this election. Bradley Byrne did so well in the area in the first round, and I'd love to have the people stand with me this time. I've stood with them, and our principles, our values, fought hard, but tried to always do it in a way that didn't that reflected credit on Alabama, not embarrassing Alabama, and do it with integrity. And I've tried to live and operate my personal affairs with high degree of integrity and impropriety. So that's the kind of thing that I do think are important in a Senate, and urging people to actually vote to be sure they do.
Let's get your take on this as we talk about absentee ballots, and just basically we're talking about people's fear of coronavirus or contracting coronavirus. So let's talk about this. City of Mobile, police jurisdiction.
Could I just mention, yeah. Interrupt?
Yeah.
Under the rules of this election, the Secretary of State has made clear, even if you're not sick, but if you fear going to the polling place because of getting sick, you can vote absentee. So basically, he said anybody that wants to vote absentee can this election.
Yep, and he's, yeah, you're right. He's, you don't have to actively be sick. Fear of sickness, he had said, was a reason. So with that being said, we're talking about coronavirus, people's fears on coronavirus. You've got mask ordinances that have gone in around the state, here at home in Mobile, City of Mobile, police jurisdiction, even Dr. Eichold said unincorporated areas of Mobile County under this mask ordinance. Now you've seen this pressure at a state level, even though Governor Ivey said she could do it. It was unenforceable at a state level. You hear pushes at a state level, and I also hear talk about a national mask mandate. From your time in the Senate, your time in Washington, what's your, just through your mind, what's your take on that?
First, I would say that I think the president has been wise not to let them push him into taking over all of this and issuing nationwide orders that don't apply to various areas. The left is pushing that. They always want the federal government to take over everything. But I know Mobile has given great thought to this. They have put out a mask ordinance. Let me say my personal view, wear a mask when you're out in groups of people. It's just whenever possible. We should be careful. We need to avoid filling up our hospitals, which is happening now, Sean. Our hospitals in Alabama are now filling up to the breaking point, and we need to slow this thing down. Masks do help. They don't guarantee anything. Washing hands does help. And if you can avoid getting sick now, who knows, we may discover more medicine that make the recovery easier and quicker, and fewer people die, and we can hold on. We'll get that vaccine surely soon that will begin to protect us from the disease. So right now is a danger time, and I know the city has given a lot of thought to it, but I'm going to try to be supportive of the wearing a mask as much as I can within reason. Some of this, you know, you're out walking in the morning or something and nobody's close by, you don't need to be wearing a mask, in my view. But using good judgment, I think is smart.
Right. You know, something you've been speaking about for a couple months here on the show with us, wonder where you are on holding China accountable on this. I mean, you've said that this is, all roads lead back to the communist Chinese on this spread of COVID-19.
Yeah, I've laid out a policy I call Betting on America. We're posting it again today. But it just, we can win this thing with China. But what the people need to know is, we are not doomed. We have so much leverage. They need us more than we need them. And they don't hold enough of our debt to be afraid of China. We can stand up to them. We have to. We have not. The globalists and the groups out there have always been soft on China. They don't want us to take strong action. The president is doing it. He needs vigorous, strong support in the Senate. People speaking up for him and defending it and helping lay out policies that can be passed on a bipartisan basis that sets us on an entirely new relationship with China, much like we did with the Soviet Union, the containment-type policy. They have got to be contained, and they're making their wealth off us, selling into our market. We can buy these products from other places. We are not dependent on China. We can certainly get along without buying products from China. We can make them at home. That'd be first. But Mexico and Canada and Australia and the Philippines and Korea and Japan, allies we can buy products from. We don't have to buy them all from China, for goodness sakes. So this is the kind of thing I think we need to focus on. I would like to be a leader on it. I, as Attorney General, we surged prosecutions of Chinese entities. There was virtually zero. There are now 50 cases ongoing with 1,000 investigations. I doubled the budget for Chinese investigations, called it the China Initiative as Attorney General. We need to do this. We cannot wait. This is our opportunity. We saw the lies that they do, the totalitarian, godless regime during the pandemic, and how they let it escape from China unbelievably.
All right.
And so that's what we need to be thinking about.
Jeff Sessions, thank you for your time. And y'all, we are just 1 week out from voting day in the runoffs. That is July 14th. All right. Mike Gallagher Show on the way next.